This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldone. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat. Welcome to episode 211 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander.
This episode, we wanted to say a few very special thank yous, and those are Anne S., Lisa M., Jessica L., Mary M., and Eve D. Now, these amazing listeners all left us a rating and review on iTunes. So if you would like a shout out, or even without a shout out, we would be honored if you have found some benefit. If you have listened to us, whether it's from day one, or you just found us recently, or you only listen to our episode discussions regarding the Stars series, we would be honored if you could let us know, number one, that you listen, and if you could leave us a rating and a review in iTunes. And if you do, let us know. Now, a little housekeeping before we get to our main content, and that is this weekend, of course, is the Outlander premiere of season 3. And just after the East Coast airing, which is at 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, Summer and I will be doing our very first live after show. So we will be doing it on Facebook, and we will be announcing very soon how you can join us.
And now, on to our read-along! This week, we are discussing chapter 63 of Voyager, the last chapter of Voyager, entitled Out of the Depths.
Eileen P. Out of the Depths is from Psalm 130, in which the psalmist expresses Christ's deep despair and his cries to God to hear his voice, to hear his cry for mercy. And she shares a link to a performance of this psalm by the Scottish Psalter Choir, and I'll share that. But she also says, however, I found a song by David Boggess that is based on Psalm 130 and refers to the ocean. This might add more meaning for Voyager. And I will include the link in the show notes as well. Erica B. writes, the island that they are headed to sounds quite lovely, according to his Wikipedia page. It's long and skinny and with beautiful beaches and lots of pineapples. While on Wikipedia, I looked up sloop so I could get a feel for the type of the size of the boat that JB and Claire and the Scottish smugglers were on and Stian. I knew in my head it wasn't large, but the picture provided in the entry was of a small boat, a smaller boat than I had thought. It's what I think of when I think of the typical sailboats I'd seen growing up at the beach in the armpit of Cape Cod. It's quite amazing to think they survived a hurricane on that thing. Being in a house in a hurricane is scary business. I cannot imagine the ordeal on a boat in the middle of the ocean. Holy moly. Lisa T. writes, throughout the story, we have seen Jamie and Claire both struggle with who they are. First, we see Jamie try to define who he is without Claire. He is a ghost in many ways. We see him later at Lallybroch, but he is no longer the laird, and he can't even live in the house. At Ardsmuir, he becomes MacDhu to his men, and he becomes their chief, only to have that taken from him when his men are transported and he is sent to Hellwater. At Hellwater, he begins to rebuild his life as a father to Willie and a friend to Lord John. Afterwards, in Edinburgh, he is A. Malcolm Printer and Jamie Roy, but never really James Fraser. We see Claire struggle to rebuild her life and identity. She's no longer Claire Fraser, but Claire Randall. Like Jamie, being a parent gives her joy and a new identity, and like Jamie, she has a true and trusted friend in Dr. Joe. She struggles to make a life with Frank. And finally, like Jamie, she finds her identity in her calling as a doctor. When Claire finally returns to Jamie, he tells her that no matter who he is, she is his wife. Even then, she is not Mrs. Fraser, she is Mrs. Malcolm. And even at Lallybroch, where they should have found peace, she finds that Jamie has since married Leary. Is Claire really still Jamie's wife? Even after sorting it out legally, she and Jamie are forced to be celibate. Over the course of their voyage, they take on many aliases. It is not until Claire learns the last of Jamie's secrets, Willie, that they finally recite their vows and are one in body, mind, and spirit. And Lisa says, G can read this aloud. Quote, I pressed my own wrist against his, pulse to pulse, heartbeat to heartbeat. Blood of my blood, I whispered. Bone of my bone. His whisper was deep and husky. He knelt quite suddenly before me and put his folded hands in mine, the gesture a Highlander makes when swearing loyalty to his chieftain. I give you my spirit, he said, head bent over our hands. Till our life shall be done, I said softly. But it isn't done yet, Jamie, is it? Then he rose and took the shift from me, and I lay back on the narrow bed, naked, thanks, Lisa. Pulled him down to me through the soft yellow light and took him home and home and home again. And we were neither one of us alone, unquote. They enter their final chapters as one, united. The entire book is about them being who they truly are. And finally, in chapter 63, Out of the Depths, not unlike the final chapter of Outlander, from the womb of the earth, after so much heartbreak and loss, they are metaphysically reborn, their identities certain. I have a feeling there's going to be a few little tear pricks in this episode here. So, on to the chapter. The morning after So I Married an Axe Murderer, they're continuing to shore. Diana says that young Ian was, quote, limping ostentatiously. Don't some dogs do that, some? Like, I swear that dogs sometimes, like, fake something to make you think, to get sympathy.
What?
I've seen dogs fake limp.
I mean, possums fake dead.
Yeah, but we're talking about Ian, who's fake limping. And I was thinking about dogs that fake limp, but definitely not cats. Cats don't give a rat's. Cats don't need to pretend. They be who they are, and they don't give a rat's if you care. As they approach the beach, so they're coming back down from Axe Murderer Station. They're coming back down away from the mountain, away from the cave, and young Ian sees the Bruja run aground and sees the escaped slaves who are running around, and he thinks, oh my gosh, it's the pirates. And Jamie calms him and says, no, that's slaves. Those are escaped slaves. And the slaves were agitated. There was another ship coming toward the island. It was a man of war.
Seriously, they have the worst luck with boats.
It's not just boats. It's Voyager. Oh, wait, what, the slaves?
No, just like every time they get on a boat, there's some other boat chasing them, boarding them, shooting at them. It's like the people who are like traffic magnets. Like no matter where they go or when they leave, they always hit traffic. It's like it's Murphy's Law of shipbuilding or ship writing, whatever you want to call it. Grange.
So as they were beginning to walk away, because they turned around and they're like, we need to get away from here. Stan noticed Lord John's pinnacle coming closely to the shore. Jamie takes a hot second to consider doing what they're about to do, and then they go for it. They make a run for the boat, and the men on the pinnacle are aiming guns at the shore. Now, Diana mentions that they had been followed. So the people, the Scottish smugglers, those who were still on the boat, were firing at an area behind Jamie, Claire, and Ian, and Stan. Wasn't Stan with them? Yeah, they found Stan. So they were all running toward the pinnacle, and the people on the pinnacle were shooting toward the beach. So my question is, who was coming after them? Slaves weren't coming after them. Who was running at? Do you see where I'm confused?
I mean, I see that you're
so
confused.
Okay, who was running after them? As it said, we had been followed. There weren't no Brits there. There was just the four of them and slaves. Unless there was the ghost of Galus Duncan, then no bullet's going to help you there. So, dear listener, please straighten me out there. What does that mean? That they had been followed? I know what that means in English, but who followed them? Who were they shooting at? Innes, on board the Pinnacle, gives orders to the men to head back out to sea once everyone's aboard. They cruise by the Porpoise, and it turns out that the Porpoise was after the slave ship. So they were going, even though it was, you know, grounded and probably not water safe, they were still going after it because they knew that there were escaped slaves there or nearby. So Jamie's orders had been followed. But when they saw the Porpoise was wanting the slave ship instead of them, they figured they'd come back and pick them up. Did I just make that up?
I don't see where it says they were followed.
Oh, no. That's olden day. It's in there because they're shooting toward the ocean. Literally, the line says we had been followed. Innes gives orders to the men to head back out to sea. They cruise by the Porpoise. Now, the Porpoise was after the slave ship. So Jamie's orders had been followed. And when they saw that the Porpoise was wanting the slave ship, it kept going toward it. They figured, okay, well, you know, they must have been wanting to come back to it and pick up, I don't know, slaves, do something there. Then they saw that even though they were going after the slave ship, the Porpoise was aiming for them. Shots were fired and they missed. They drove the boat or sailed the boat in an erratic course to be a more difficult target to hit. So basically kind of zigzag. And then they...
So it's like evading a crocodile.
And then they heard the Porpoise shoot the Bruja. Wood erupted and so did, among a number of things, the body parts of slaves. So they were just shooting into this
brutal
mass of people.
I mean, it's like they were just angry and taking it out on everybody around them. They were like equal opportunity assholes.
Eileen P. writes, in the final chapter of Voyager, we learn the tragic end of the Jamaican Maroons. As they escape Jamaica in the stolen Bruja, it is beached on Hispaniola. The Porpoise catches up with them and guns the Maroons down as they flee on the beach. It is tragic and inhumane. By sundown, they were nearing Grand Turk Island. They slept a bit, and in the morning, it was the Porpoise again. It's the English, and they've guessed their heading, they believe. They had to work hard to stay out of their firing distance. So the Pinnacle heads east out to sea. The following morning, they were further out, but the Porpoise was still tailing them. This whole chapter is like enough of the Porpoise already. Closer, the Porpoise shot again and missed. The Pinnacle could do nothing but continue straight on. The Porpoise shot about every 10 minutes. And then it begins to rain. While the wind and strong sea affect the Pinnacle, they affect the Porpoise even worse. It stopped firing, and they see it had even lost part of a mast. Now, by that evening, the storm hits them solidly. Now, I'm thinking about this time that Jimmy doesn't seem ill, yet Diana didn't tell us that Claire had given him the needles. You know what I mean? So I was thinking about that.
What if he just wears them full-time
like Hellraiser?
Now. Yeah, they just never take him out.
Anne S. writes, enough with the Porpoise already. Do they have nothing better to do? If they had stayed in port, they would have survived. Well, most likely, you don't know for sure, but much more likely than an open sea.
Yeah, but if they'd stayed in port, wouldn't they have just been gunned down with the rest of the Maroons?
No, he means that the Porpoise had stayed in port. It wouldn't have.
Oh, okay.
That night, they experienced major squalls slamming them into the sea. The Porpoise, they see, is literally falling apart. And it finally sinks. I don't know about you. I mean, I know it's like with the Titanic, with this, with just different movies I've seen where wherever a ship is sinking, it's always sad to me. Even if there are bad guys on the ship. I'm not saying that that's wonderful, but it's always sad to me when a ship goes down. Maybe it's just part of that romanticism of Western classical literature or Western civilization, you know, that romanticizes shipping so much. I don't know, but it was sad. Could you imagine being there on the Pinnacle watching this? Like knowing that your ship is even weaker than theirs, although that was why it was, you know, it was falling apart because it was bigger and there was more stuff to be caught on the wind and everything. knowing you were just as close to death as they were. So scary. Now, Innes is guiding the boat, and there are huge waves that rise up. And in one of these waves, Claire sees the bodies, some of the bodies of the men from the Porpoise, including Captain Thomas Leonard. Martina P. writes, "The master of storytelling at work once again when we get this perfect and detailed description of the sea storm, the shipwrecks, and the sinking of the Porpoise. Claire's description of the huge wall of water and the image of Captain Leonard is somewhat surreal, but so beautiful. Claire goes overboard and Jamie jumps after her and saves her life when she seemed willing to give up fighting." So we're almost there, not quite.
That's just a funny choice of words to say she goes overboard. Yes, she physically goes overboard, like overboard of the ship, but she usually kind of goes overboard.
Yes, that's true.
In general.
The horizon, Diana tells us, has an eerie green glow to it. And just then a wave strikes and Claire is thrown off the deck. She describes it as there being only darkness. Quote, "Everything was dark. There was nothing but sensation and all of that intense, but indistinguishable. Pressure and noise and overwhelming cold," unquote. Now, does this not remind you a little bit of her going through the stones? Maybe not pressure, but just that the darkness, the kind of the void. It just reminded me of that. She couldn't feel the pull of her clothes or the rope at her waist. It's so funny. It's not funny, but it's kind of funny how Diana writes, she describes that someone has urinated and she feels it around her legs, but she doesn't know if it's her own or the last remnants of someone who's, you know, just died in the water too. I wrote in parentheses, "Keeping it real, D." Her head hits something and she's coughing. She's finally back on the deck of the Pinnacle. The sky is now purple green. Now she has a pain in her side and she feels raw skin, the raw skin from the rope around her waist. Her clothes are a mess as far as sticking to her, and all of the passengers were huddled in the small protection that the mast provided. Lightning and thunder, and in the middle of this, Claire has a flash of Joe Abernathy singing "Dem Bones, Dem Bones," and the head bones connected to the neck bone, that old song. And she has what appears or seems to be hysterical laughter. It's good to know that I'm not the only one who gets hysterical laughter there. Good to know. And when she hears a thunderclap, she has a shock of memory of holding a skull back in the 20th or forward in the 20th century. She has recognition. She knows whose skull she was holding. Now that coloring of the sky, coloring of the horizon, it was St. Elmo's fire that was lighting up the sea and sky. A fireball dropped to the deck. Now this description of Jamie, it just made me laugh. Scary, but made me laugh. Jamie had tried to bat it away and he looked it. Quote, "Loose ends of his hair standing out from his head, coated with fire and streaming backwards like a demon's. Streaks of vivid blue outlined the fingers of his hand when he brushed his hair from his face," unquote. Now he touches Claire and the jolt goes through her. Finally, rain comes. But not just rain, hail. So since they were very thirsty, they would all collect the hail and then drink it. And I think it was Innes. Someone gathered it into a bucket. I had a bucket there somewhere to store it. Eileen P. writes, "Isn't it enough to be pursued by the porpoise and sailing through a storm? Let's make it worse. Add St. Elmo's fire. Time to pray. Psalm 130, out of the depths." Erica B. writes, "An interesting thing about watching a hurricane approach is watching the cloud bands and their shapes. It's very specific. Others who have experienced hurricanes, I'm sure, would agree. It's unclear if Claire noticed the cloud patterns. Quick Google search of major hurricanes in New England shows that about 9 storms affected New England, mostly southern Massachusetts, during her time in Boston. So hurricanes shouldn't be an unknown to her, or when hurricane season is, June to November. Do we know what month we are in the story? I've lost track, but I do know that when I first read the story and they encountered the storm, I knew what it was." I don't know. I think I've stopped because I didn't see a textual mention of it. I stopped putting, you know, like times or months at this moment. Now, Claire could at least attempt to sleep at this moment. Now, no one can tell the time of day because the sky was completely, you know, cloudy because of the sky. The sea is still rolling, but the wind was slightly quieter. Finally, Jamie says that the storms passed. Lisa T. writes, quote, I slept intermittently, head lolling on Jamie's shoulder, and woke to find the wind still screaming. Numb to terror now, I only waited. Whether we lived or died seemed of little consequence, if only the dreadful noise would stop. Unquote. Not unlike the sound of the stones. They struggled with the element of earth in the cave. Now they are struggling against water, air, and fire. So they had no compass on the pinnacle. It had been melted by their visitor, the fireball. And Stan says that they must be heading west, that was where, even though they didn't know where they were, if they would head west, they would surely hit land. Jamie doesn't care where they go so long as it's land. Then we find out why Jamie hasn't been puking. He hasn't eaten anything the last 2 days. The next thing Diana writes.
But that didn't stop him from puking like a dry originally.
Puke. Yeah, a dry puke, a dry heave. Yeah.
Yeah, he was like, that's why he thought he was for sure dying because he was just puking up stomach acid. So that must have just been an attempt at being clever because that was not something us that saved him.
Well, think about it. This is the roughest sea he's ever been on. If homeboy is ever going to barf, it's going to be now. So I don't know about
that. Right. But what I'm saying is that him not eating didn't stop him from being unbearably seasick on calmer water before.
The next thing Diana writes, and I'm like, how did I forget this? I was shocked. 5 days later, they find land. So they were living off of that, whatever water that was, for 5 days. I don't know how you do that. 5 days. Claire tries to say something to Jamie, and once again, she's down and out. She's thrown into the water. Again. Something this time is pulling her down. Jamie helps her. Of course, he dives in the water. He helps her by removing whatever it was on her leg, and her leg is extremely painful. She thinks it might be broken, but she's not sure. She doesn't know if she's losing blood, but she is definitely losing consciousness. Now, it seems that they get separated from each other momentarily during a wave. And during this time, she is surrounded. Diana describes it several times, mentions the word peace. She feels surrounded by peace. She feels content and she has no pain. The whole time, Jamie is yelling at her to hold on. Quote, damn you, I swear if you die on me, I'll kill you. Unquote.
I said, I hate you.
Tell people why, here in the middle of our episode, you're saying you hate me.
Because we legit finished the whole read-along and we're discussing after chapter things, after book things, and all of a sudden Ginger looks down and says, uh-oh. And I'm like,
but
what?
See, little does she says, know.
You're gonna hate me. And the second she said you're gonna hate me, I was like, you're not recording, are you?
Lisa T. writes, now Jamie and Claire are alone in the water as they were in the last chapter of Outlander. Granted, the circumstances are a wee bit different, but they are holding tightly together in the womb-like ocean. The next thing she's aware of, she's feeling peace, and she coughs. Then she feels the pain in her leg.
Oh my God, have you ever, like, I used to hate when I would have any kind of body pain and then a cough.
Because it makes it worse.
Because, like, it could be on the completely other end of my body and have nothing to do with my lungs or my head or any part of me that I think is going to cough. But it's like every part of your body tenses when you cough.
Totally.
Like, muscles you didn't think were connected all hurt totally. When you cough. So, good grief.
Jamie gets Claire to blow her nose. Her sinuses had been full of seawater.
I think that sounds soothing.
It kind of does.
I really enjoy my neti pot.
I have to tell you, and this is going to sound really weird, but from what you just said, then you might appreciate it. I learned a lesson why, obviously, you don't want to use in your neti pot or squishy pouch, whatever that's called.
Squishy pouch?
You can get the plastic. Like, I have a silicone, little silicone bottle.
It's a squishy pouch
bottle.
I've never heard anyone call that squishy pouch. That sounds like a nutsack.
Whatever. Squishy you take pouch. Your neti pot or mock pot and you supposed to be or like body like pouch. Body temperature water, right? So warm. And not correct. Faucet water. You want to use
where are you putting your
distilled water
pouch?
That has been boiled because little bugs are in things and people get brain stuff. So anyway, you put your saline solution in. You do whatever you're going to do. I have learned the hard way. When I thought the water wasn't that hot, I have like burned my sinuses and I've frozen my sinuses and it is not fun. But if you get...
Well, you know, there is the right blend of all yes. of those things. You have to Goldilocks your neti pot. Because there's too hot, too cold, too yes. little salt, yes. too much salt. Like, and the feeling of too little salt hurts just it's as weird. Bad as it's too weird. Much yeah. salt.
It's a different kind of...
Yeah, it's there. Yeah. You have to be, like, pH balanced and temperature gauged perfection for the ultimate neti pot experience, which I don't think the ocean
no,
would
gosh,
have provided.
No. But if it's the right conditions... And you do it in the water, especially, I mean, the salty, yes, that's important, but especially if it's the water temperature is just right. Okay, I'm not going to say it's orgasmic. I'm not going to say that. But you put it in your...
It's equivalent of oh. a Q-tip in your ear. I know you're not supposed to do it, oh, but it feels summer. Real
and
good
me
if
in
you
my
do it
ear,
just right.
I'm not going to say what is, but that's all kind of... nice. Neti pot, okay. the feeling of the water in your sinuses, it's really like, the first time you do it, you're like, what the heck? And then you like, it's almost like, again, not the same thing, but it's almost like, you know, when you're watching that movie Abyss and she goes under with the, that mask on that has the oxygen filled liquid.
Oh, the she dude. She doesn't do that.
And
that's a dude.
He's like fighting yeah. it, right? But after he fights it and he yeah. allows it into his, sinuses, lungs, all that.
Lungs.
He realizes he gets oxygen. That's kind of how I feel, although obviously not life and death dramatic like that. That's kind of how I feel about the neti pot. Not every time, but in the beginning. You put it in and it's not that you want to fight it, but you're just not, it's like we're not meant for that or we're not used to it. But then once it's in there, you're just like,
I want you to know that you could legitimately take the word neti pot out and replace that word with many different things. And this whole conversation would have many different connotations
okay.
because it doesn't belong in there. But once it's in there and then insert your funny noise.
Oh, Lord. So like squishy pot, pouch. Pouch,
squishy pot,
squishy pouch, squishy pouch, squishy pouch. Where are they shoving you? Okay,
no, keep your squishy pouch out of the places it doesn't belong. It'll never feel
ouch.
Right.
She finds herself after she's, you know, she's wakened, or she comes to. She finds herself in a bed, a real life bed. Lisa T writes. It reminds me of a newborn child and how you must clear their nose and mouth so they can breathe. It's as though Claire is reborn from the sea. Jamie, too, of course, but he is bringing her into a new world. Get it? The new world. And you know I had mm-hmm. to do it. A whole new world. That's where we'll be. What's the rest of it?
I'm not going to do it because then you'll keep singing.
For you and me. That's the boy part. No. Was that the girl part? Was that Jasmine?
That was... Move on.
Martina P. writes, Claire wakes up in a real bed with fresh linen and takes inventory, assessing her condition in a totally peaceful place. The moment that almost takes my breath away is when Claire asks, quote, just how long did you hold on? Unquote. And Jamie simply answers, long enough. I love this and find the statement immensely powerful. Jamie held on long enough for their love, for their marriage, and their life together. So they both think that her leg is most likely broken, and they also find out that they are at a place called Les Perles. They were taken in by some very, like, some good Samaritans, by some nice people who helped them off the beach. Jamie is describing to Claire what had happened to her. So he says the top mast had snapped, he believes, and she was knocked overboard. There was a bit of rigging tangled around her leg. He just held on to her, and eventually he felt the sand under his feet. He took her to shore, and then they were found. And he says also that the men were safe, he believes. Now, Jamie speaks for all of us who have swum or more in the ocean when he describes sand in the crack of his arse.
Yeah. It hasn't happened to me often since I became an adult, but it was a pretty constant companion in childhood. Sand in my crack. And I remember one of the trips we went to the beach, and I don't think there was a shower long enough to get all the sand out of my crack. I think I was still picking sand out of my butt when we returned home from the beach
well,
vacation.
You wanted that souvenir.
I think that was the time we tried body surfing, and I got trapped in a wave which dumped me into the sand in several different directions.
You didn't have any sand issues this trip, right? This year?
No, because I'm grown. I know how to not sit down in the sand.
Someone we know is sitting in the sand, all kinds of sand.
Dude, you know, it's not an appreciation for sand. My relationship with sand has changed a lot since having children, or child, I should say, in that cleaning sand out of your own butt is one thing, but having to help someone else clean sand out of their butt is a whole new experience that I hope you never have to experience.
A whole new butt. She doesn't want to there be. I'm just kidding. So basically, the more sand that she got, your daughter, was from when sitting in it, playing in it, that kind of thing.
Yeah. But I mean, there was times when she would just sit on the sand right next to the edge of the water. So the water was constantly pushing more sand on her.
Just seeing that would make me go like, I don't want sand. Yeah, I don't want to play that game. I don't want to have to clean.
It's like that fear of, how do you know you got it all? I mean, it's not like you're going to have an oyster in there. You're going to make a pearl.
So we had sand or no, we had a lot of showers because we were slathered down with
sunscreen makes it stick to you even more.
And so we were showering, like, I think we showered like twice a day. At least one.
And is that counting the showers?
No,
at the
beach? At the hotel. One, definitely whenever we swam in the water, in the beach. In the ocean, is that better? In the water, at the beach, on the sand, next there to the
you
thing.
Go. You don't swim.
Whenever we swam in the ocean or entered the ocean, more than just feet, even when it was just feet, and then had to cross the sand back up to the pavement or whatever, I fell in love with those showers. Every time I saw one, I used it.
All of them? They were all over the place. There were some just on the main street.
No, not like whenever, not literally in on the street, but after I had been around sand or in sand or walked around a beach or whatever, I loved it. I wish that, maybe I just haven't been to enough beaches, but I wish that were commonplace at like all beaches or all coastal areas. Because that was amazing. Thank you, State of Hawaii. That was awesome. But yeah, so sand is awesome outside the crack.
Sand is great on your feet. When you're walking, it's like an exfoliator.
It's like a little, it's like a free exfoliation.
Pedicure. Yeah.
So Claire realizes she was naked under the sheets. Jamie had removed her clothing to be able to continue to hold on to her. So her clothing was so heavy, or there was so much of it, and it probably was heavy too. And the water was pulling on it, the current, that he just, in order to be able to keep a hold of her, he had to strip her basically. And he had to get rid of his own stuff as well.
Likely excuse. Sounds like he was trying to get some in the ocean.
Lisa T writes, to continue on the theme of being born, and of course the theme of Claire being naked as she transitions from her old life to her new one. Yes, Claire is once again naked like a newborn baby. But clothes also play an important role in defining who she is. At the hospital, she wore scrubs, for example. The fact that she has no clothes now also means that she can begin her life with her true identity as Claire Fraser. But, as I said, Jamie had to get rid of something too, and that was his coat. And the pictures of Brianna were gone. He had, however, kept a number of stones magically. So did that just kill you about the pictures?
It just makes me sad.
So sad.
I mean, knowing what I know, I'm maybe as not sad. As sad. However, I mean, that's you just those are legitimately
irreplaceable. They are, but they're also.
And I get sad losing anything irreplaceable.
Or witch trial evidence. So evidence that can be that can have someone burned. I'm just saying at this time it's scary stuff.
Yes. However, it's not the time period for that, is it?
Well, 20 years.
When were the witch trials?
Before Claire had almost been burned.
No. I mean, in America.
I don't know the complete history of witch trials in America. I know that our most famous ones were in the late 17th century. So that would have been, it was 1692, I believe, the Salem witch trials.
Yeah. So she's probably safe.
Yeah, that's true. And there's a book 9 coming out, and I'll give you a little spoiler. Claire's in it. So she's probably
safe. She hasn't died yet.
And Jamie's in it too. I'll just tell you that much. So even the Adamant, the little jewel, a little while later, a woman comes into their room and we learn that it's the owner, the proprietress of Les Perles. Now, Jamie thanks her for letting them stay. And we find out that young Ian and the other men are actually being fed right then in her kitchen. She is Patsy Olivier, Mrs. Joseph Olivier. Jamie and Claire look at each other and try to figure out what to say. What is going on here? She's English, Patsy, and her husband, Joseph, is French. What to do? What about alliances? Where are we at? What's going on? Jamie asks.
I just love that they made it the most confusing way to figure out where they are ever. They're like, well, she's English, but her last name is French. We could literally be anywhere. Are we back on the island?
Maybe they blew us to France. I mean, maybe not.
Right. Oh, Lord. Could you imagine?
That would be too much. That'd be too much. So Jamie asks where they are, finally. And he says, what island are we on? And the woman's like, oh, dear child. No, just kidding. They are in Georgia. The colony, the American colony of Georgia. They had been blown 600 miles by that ding-dong hurricane. And of course, when I was reading it, I thought of, in the eye of the hurricane, there is silence. But of course, there wasn't silence for them. There's all kinds of shizzle. So they are in America, the new world. For them, at this moment, that means freedom. That settled, Jamie introduces himself to Patsy as Jamie Fraser and his wife as Claire.
So I know you got choked up. Did you get choked? What were the moments in this chapter that choked
you up? Two things. Well, I know there was more than one in the chapter, but the two things that stand out was the ending. There was like nothing terrifically sad. Like it was a happy end, but just the ending made me like choke up. I was like, damn you, Diana. And then Martina's comment about when she says some comment she made me, let me find it. When she said, oh, when she was quoting, because I didn't cry when I read it, but when Martina wrote about it, I had a little tear jerk. Tear prick.
You're such a tear jerk.
That's funny. When she was quoting Jamie and Claire, when Claire said, how long did you hold up? Did you hold on? And he said, long enough. That mm-hmm. when she quoted that back to Mer, I lost it. So the ending was the one thing that I lost it at. And then when she quoted that. So where did you lose it at?
I lost it. Well, I mean, I was saddened by the loss of the photographs, but I got choked up and got like glassy eyed when he introduces himself as James Fraser, just because it's the moment, the first moment that they've ever been together, really ever. Really, really, really ever, where they're in a place where no one already hates them and there's no one already trying to kill them or plot their death or turn them in for something. They're not already in trouble. Like they have a chance. to make their own future,
willing to be there at this moment. Because remember, when she first came back, even though she found happiness with Jamie, she did not mean to come back. That trip was an accident. So she straight up came back for him and then all the stuff. So yeah, I agree. 100%. Anne S. writes, Claire goes overboard and then thinks she's dead. Just as Jamie's story began. She finds she's alive, but she also wonders if she is whole. Jamie is with her. She is whole, and they have finally made it to the Americas. And after half a dozen or so different identities, Jamie can finally be his true self, James Fraser and his wife, Claire. Okay, TV show note. This is from Anne. Diana has stated that she has seen the first 9 episodes, and the answer of Frank's marital fidelity is answered without doubt. What do you think the answer will be? Yes or no? Now, before we get to that, Anne, I have a little caveat to put in there. So, Anne, you're correct, mostly correct. Diana did not say the answer to the question, or the question was answered in the show. Yes and no, not the answer, meaning the only / definitive answer. Diana has said that an answer was given because of what they were writing and how much they had to do. They had to make a choice. Whatever it was, they had to make that choice to be able to further the season. And what Diana is saying is that they chose an answer. And it worked out really well for what they did with the season. So Diana never said that they gave the definitive answer, if I read correctly. So I just want to preface what Summer and I are going to discuss or say about this with that. Diana never said that I read. The writers answered the question definitively, and you'll see it in the series. No. They had to make a choice to be able to develop that storyline, other storylines, and have everything mirror that. So otherwise it's too much up in the air. So I could completely understand why they would do that, to be able to have clarity, whichever side it lands on, it almost doesn't matter. They just needed to answer that question for the purpose of the show. That's it. And that's why it's an adaptation. And the book, which I know we're not, I know we're not discussing right now. Damn it, Ginger, that's all we're discussing right now. Sorry. The book, and people are on both sides. People have, and there, I think you can find evidence if you look for it, or if you want to use it for that, for either side. Diana has said certain things. Many people agree. Many people disagree. And I'm kind of on the fence, but you guys know about this. So Summer, we've already hashed this out between us earlier in the book. If you want to state your case, that's fine. But we don't necessarily need to rehash that. However, if we get back to Anne's question, she is basically asking, what do you think the answer will be? Yes or no?
I'm torn. And the reason I'm torn is because they love Frank.
You're right.
They love Frank.
You're right.
And I don't know if they love him because he's flawed or if they love him because he's a saint.
They love him because he's Tobias.
Ugh. Anyway, they loved him before he was Tobias. And I'm not ughing on it being Tobias. I don't think that's the only reason. I know that the writers have loved that character before they hired Tobias. So... are they Tobiased? Maybe. Yeah. Hey, I don't know. I just don't know. I think it could go either way.
Well, okay. Let me preface this by saying Summer and I have no insider exclusive knowledge or access to anything. And what I have done is when that article came out, or that interview with Diana came out about this choice, about this answer, is that there was a lot of speculation, of course, just like we're doing now. A lot of stuff on sites, on Twitter, on Facebook, in groups, etc. And I can't read everything, but I skim a lot. I skim through a lot. And from what I gathered, the overall, not 100%, but the general consensus was that he, for the purpose of the story, of the television adaptation, the consensus that people believed was that he did cheat. But I don't know where this came in, but they had an agreement or an understanding. Again, I have absolutely no proof of that. We haven't seen anything. We don't know. But that was the, and there are some very smart people out there who make really educated guesses. I read that it was, people mostly were saying they believed it was a definitive yes that he cheated. But because, like you said, they're such fans of Frank, they wouldn't want him to come off as a complete jerk. So that they believe that the way it would be allowed slash introduced was as his side or part of an understanding. So it's still technically cheating because you're married, yes, but it was something that they discussed, and it wasn't necessarily a huge betrayal. That was what kind of the gist, what people were thinking was. How does that sit with you?
I think it almost sounded like you just said jizz.
Summer. No, I said jerk, not jizz.
No, you said jizz.
I know I said jizz.
I don't know. I'm trying to not think about it. I'm kind of trying to wait and be open to whatever they decide to make their decision with. Because, I mean, I'm, as a book reader, I think he cheated. Mm-hmm. That's how I read it. That's how I read it 20 years ago. That's how I read it today. It's been colored by multiple rereads, and I expect it now. As a show watcher, I don't know what they're going to do. Do I care more deeply about it because it's Tobias Menzies? No, because I still am annoyed that it's Frank. I don't want her home with Frank. I want her with Jamie. In my brain, that's where she belongs. So I get annoyed by any sidetracked storyline that keeps her further and further away from him. But I do enjoy Tobias Menzies and his portrayal of Frank. I don't know what they're going to choose to do. I look forward to seeing what that decision is, because I literally think they could go either way.
Yeah. Oh, totally. Like I said, that was just the general consensus of what I gathered from the reaction of people. But we're all going to learn together, people. And that's so exciting. Eileen P. writes, when Claire wakes up, she thinks, I was dead. This reminds me of the beginning of Voyager when Jamie wakes up after Culloden. Chapter one begins, quote, he was dead. However, his nose throbbed painfully, which he thought odd in the circumstances, unquote. And she continues, hello, Georgia. Jamie and Claire are together. They have Ian. They have Galis's gems. No more aliases. They are Jamie and Claire Fraser. Welcome to America. I want to live in America, America, America. You want me to finish this now, please? Okay.
I do.
That's pretty cute, though.
So desperately.
How many different shows have I sung from? Like five so far?
Too many.
Five too many
shows.
Or six too many, because I'm going to have another one. I don't know. I'm just kidding. I don't know. They're never planned. They just come out. Joe B. writes, Claire is relieved to be in America. Claire is relieved to be in America. I tickle myself so much. Okay. Its ideals of freedom, hope, and refuge offered in the new world reassure her of safety, especially now that she has Jamie and can keep him. Voyager Chapter 1 starts with a name, Jamie Fraser, and, quote, what's in a name? Unquote, is a central theme across the book, especially as he has had so many. Claire, too, has had many identities. Now, together, they can face the new world confidently as Jamie Fraser and his wife, Claire. Lorraine B. writes, as they leave Fergus and Marsali safely behind and flee the British, Diana takes us on a roller coaster ride up and down the terrifying swells and troughs and through the wickedest storm ever. It was a shame that the crew of the Porpoise didn't make it, and I sincerely hope that Annika and her goats were not on board. Diana has a knack of giving life to and making us care for the minorest of characters, and I became somewhat verklempt at the loss of the Porpoise and her crew. This book is perhaps my favorite of the series. So many things happen that have a satisfying resolve, and it ends with the promise of more to come. Truly the mark of a talented author. Martina P. writes, finally, we leave Claire and Jamie in the promising, optimistic, and safe new world. In a place where they are completely free to be themselves for the very first time since they met. They can introduce themselves with their real names in total freedom. Everything comes together, and this is the perfect and most satisfying end to this wonderful book. No cliffhanger. Instead, it just leaves me utterly and completely happy for Jamie and Claire, wanting to go on and learn about their new beginning and new life in the colonies, where both of them will be Outlanders. Lisa T. writes, I find it interesting that the books start off with Jamie having an injured leg, and it concludes with Claire having one. Is that a grande moment? I think back to a much earlier chapter when Jamie questioned whether it was right for him to have Claire. What is it, Jamie? She asks. He whispers, is it wrong for me to have you? His face was bone white, his eyes no more than dark pits in the dim light. Quote, I keep thinking, is it my fault? Have I sinned so greatly, wanting you so much, needing you more than life itself? Unquote. Perhaps losing the pictures of his children is some small bit of retribution, perhaps not. But with their ordeals, it is almost as though there is a price to be paid for them to be together. And maybe it really doesn't matter whether there's a price or not. Finally, at long last, refuge and freedom, two things which have eluded Jamie and Claire throughout Voyager. So now, safe and together in America, Jamie and Claire can be exactly who they are. No more aliases, no more hiding. I'll let herself conclude my wee thoughts. Quote, Jamie straightened his shoulders and smiled back at her. The clean, bright air stirred his hair like kindling flames. In that case, ma'am, he said, my name is Jamie Fraser. He looked then at me, eyes blue and brilliant as the sky behind him, and his heart beat strong in the palm of my hand. And this is Claire, he said, my wife.
Yay.
Diana.
Are you crying?
Yes.
Ugh.
You're crying?
Yes, I said.
You're such a baby.
You're such a robot. It's okay.
I am.
Okay. So.
Beep bop. Beep,
beep. So that was. Okay. That. Oh my God. Not only was that chapter 63, people, that was Voyager. Holy doodles. Okay. Are we ready to say an official goodbye to Voyager?
It's time.
Oh Lord. And that, dear listener, is goodbye to Voyager. And until we meet again for our next read-along for Drums of Autumn, thank you as always, dear listener, for joining us. We look forward to our next episode. Thank you to our generous partner, Zencastr, who offers high-fidelity podcasting. Check out Zencastr and use coupon code OUTLANDER20, OUTLANDER20, for 20% off 3 months or 20% off for a year. Connect with us. Visit our website at outlanderpod.com. Find us on Facebook, facebook.com/outlanderpod. We'd love for you to join our Facebook community at outlanderpod.com/group. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at outlanderpod.